I'm Greg Johnson. Welcome to Countercurrents Radio. My guest today from Kiev, Ukraine, is Kurt Doolittle. Kurt, welcome to the show.
Hi, Greg. Thanks for having me on. I'm really excited.
Well, Kurt, I first got to know you through your appearances at the Daily Show. You did a couple of interviews over there at TRS, and I thought you had a really interesting perspective on civilization. So tell us a little bit about yourself. Give us some background on who you are, and tell us a bit about the ideas that you're passionate about, the work that you do.
Okay, so just the three basics, personal career and what I do for philosophy is I'm from a small town in upstate New York. It's frozen in the pre-war era. It's a bunch of little old Victorian houses. It's gorgeous. It's sort of idyllic. Spent most of my adult life in Seattle I studied fine art, so I have an education art theory. And I spent most of my career in Seattle building tech companies. I've built a bunch of companies, and they're not interesting to anybody, but they're fairly sizable, and they've been fairly successful. So I have the luxury now to write full time, which was always my ambition. And I have a wonderful little company here I'm working on. Started out as a hobby, but it's turned out to be something really quite interesting. So that's it. So personally, I'm just a serial entrepreneur a frustrated artist, one or the other, who went into the technology business for purely monetary reasons and with the ambition to make enough money to be able to afford to work on my philosophy full time. That's what I do.
Did you study philosophy as well when you were in university, or was it primarily art?
I study a lot of things. I'm not really suitable for the academic environment because I don't really want to explore what anybody wants me to. I want to explore the world the way I want to, and I'm slightly autistic in the Asperger spectrum, so I tend to absorb information on my own terms fairly rapidly, and so I honestly learned almost all of my philosophy on my own, which honestly I'm in the camp the great books are very accessible, and if you just read through them, it's about all there is to do.
That sounds fair. So tell us about your philosophy, your Propertarian Institute, and the ideas that you're trying to make more broadly known.
Right, so I started out with the ambition, really, was very simple, is that I was very frustrated by I don't know if you remember this period, but when the Democratic Party used to get on the news channel and their whole thing was just stay on message, no matter what the interviewer asks, just repeat the propaganda statement. And I got very frustrated in that time period because conservatives, first of all, were just trying to fall into the mistake that our media still does, which was you'd sort of try to understand both sides when the other person doesn't want you to understand, they just want to repeat. And the second thing was conservatives couldn't, and libertarians too, couldn't articulate their ideas. And conservatives in particular, they speak in a very old language. It's very metaphorical, if not religious, moralistic language, historical language. It's not a ratio-empirical system of thought. And if you go to the 20th century conservatives, I mean, like even like Russell Kirk, I mean, it's just a sort of romantic pseudo poetry. Doesn't even really qualify as rational philosophy. It certainly isn't analytic philosophy, which is sort of a scientific look at the world. So I set out to solve that problem. I ended up in doing far more than my original ambition, but so that's what I actually started out to do. What I ended up with in Propertarianism was how do I solve the problem of heterogeneity? You know, take this language. Now that I have this language, how do I explain the West, the success of the West, and what is the cause of the success of the West? you know, what separates the West from the rest? And I think you've probably seen the various books on authors over the past two decades trying to explain this. And then, lastly, I wanted to say, once I understand that, how do I recreate it? And in the process, I sort of tried to come up with the institutional framework for heterogeneous polities. I'm not one of these reactionaries that says we're going to go back to the past and, you know, in feudal kingdoms. I wanted to find some way to create a, you know, whatever the next version of politics is, it's a heterogeneous polity. And so I sort of got there. What I didn't expect to do was accomplish the Wilsonian synthesis, which is the unification of morality, philosophy, science, law, and politics. I didn't really expect to do all that, especially to unify philosophy and science, but that is a sort of accident I ended up with. And that's, if you knew what that was, that there's E.O. Wilson put out a claim that in the near future this would happen. And so I think I've sort of stumbled onto this answer. Worked pretty hard, but I mean, I did stumble into it. It didn't occur to me. So propertarianism is, if you think about it, it's a philosophical framework for the construction of political orders. But the point of it is just how to do it truthfully. So my position is I don't care what political order you want to construct, but as long as you construct it truthfully, then that's fine. And if you do that, you can, I don't care if you want to create your anarchic polity or whatever, but you can do these things fairly honestly. So that was what I got to. What surprised me was that the secret of our Western history is that we actually invented truth telling. And to us, that's kind of a silly concept. I mean, how can you say we invented truth telling? Well, you know, telling the truth is expensive. That's why nobody does it. It's incredibly hard norm to build. We're the only people who did it. And because we did it, we created, you know, truth telling. We could have the jury. We could have the common law. We didn't have to have centralized bureaucracies to centralized orders. We could keep distributed aristocratic and egalitarian frameworks. And furthermore, we didn't have the pressure of the river valleys that, you know, the Fertile Crescent has, China has, that the Indus River Valley, the river valleys have in India. And so we didn't have to manage irrigation. And because we didn't have to manage irrigation, we didn't have to create hierarchical polities either. So between heroism, truth-telling, and not having to have, you know, basically we call it individualistic or family production, you know, small farms, we didn't develop any of the authoritarian structures or the demand for them that everybody else did.
Yeah, that's very interesting. I'm just sort of ranging in my mind as you speak.
I know you have some similar ideas. People said we should talk, so.
Yeah, I'm just thinking of my study of Greek philosophy. Truth-telling is very important to the Greeks. The ethics of Aristotle, for instance, one of our moral perfections is frankness, right?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And there's a real concern with establishing ways that accurate information will flow through society. And one of the things that I found very interesting in Aristotle's discussion of magnanimity or greatness of soul, which really for him is sort of a virtue that presupposes the possession of all the other virtues. It's the state of being supremely morally accomplished and knowing it, right? Mm-hmm. He said the magnanimous individual, it was frank in his dealings with other people rather than deceptive, except in his dealings with inferiors. And the reason why you have this idea of not being totally frank in dealings with inferiors is because if you're in a social hierarchy, a superior position in a social hierarchy, it's very, very important to make sure that your underlings tell you the truth. And if you are completely frank with them about their mistakes, sometimes they'll hide the truth rather than reveal it to you. And so one of the characteristics of the great souled man is that he's ironic, in Aristotle's term. And by irony, that means, in this context, dissimulation. It can actually be translated, for instance, in Plato's Symposium, as condescension. Mm-hmm. Although no one is supposed to know you're condescending to them or makes them angry. But the point is that it's permissible to talk down to people and to be really gentle with them.
Of course. I mean, you talk down to you. I mean, you don't tell your children the absolute truth all the time.
Yeah.
It's like giving them scissors, intellectual scissors to run with sometimes.
Right, right.
And you have to give people information. But, the problem is that I understand that statement, but I don't know what to do with it. Because what do you tell somebody other than, well, you know, when you're young, you don't know anything. All you can do is imitate. You take on virtue ethics. When you're middle, you know, you become a young adult and you understand what the rules are, you can adopt rule-based ethics, you know, follow basic rules. When you're older and wiser and you know about the world, you can adopt outcome-based ethics. And, you know, that's what we do. And so, I mean, when you're older and when you're young, you imitate the people who are virtuous. When you're middle age, you understand the rules and try to operate with them because that's a little more granular and precise. And when you're older and you've accumulated enough information, you get pretty paternal about the world. And I think that's the advice we have to take from that viewpoint. And, you know, but I'm not sure, you know, we get into the problem of that's a matter for close relations. And that's, you know, your family, your children, your friends, your coworkers, your employees, your local community. I'm not sure what it does for us in the problem of politics. But
it strikes me as interesting that truth-telling and frankness are regarded as virtues by the Greeks, and really the only way in which not telling the full truth is licensed by mm-hmm. somebody like Aristotle would actually seem to support making it more likely that people will tell you the truth, because
yeah,
if you don't blow up and get really angry with them when you bring them, you know, bad news or something like that, chances are you're going to get accurate information even if it's not what you want to hear. And so there's a real sense that by lowering the costs of telling the truth and by upping our willingness to take risks to tell the truth,
there you go.
We're creating a society where truth-telling is highly valued, and I see that very consistently with Greek ethics.
And so what flipped that around? So what's happened in the 20th century?
Well, you tell me.
What's happened in the 20th century is the reversal of that,
mm-hmm.
is that they've raised the cost of truth-telling.
Oh, yeah.
This is the postmodern project, right? I mean, is to deny reality, to make us lie, to be unscientific, to be pseudoscientific, to tell them every falsehood in the possible in order to create, the kind of truth that it's not really truth, but, you know, the sociologically constructed truth rather than objective truth. So I like the way you brought it into cost, because that's the way I try to frame these things, is that truth's expensive. It's expensive for the individual. So if you're in an area like the Levant where there's a crushing interaction of different polities all the time, you know, you're sort of at the clover intersection of the Eurasian and African continents, you know, you get a lot of tribal pressures in there and a lot of competitors, and, you know, there's just not very much value in paying the cost of truth-telling. Certainly in Asia, you know, the first real Chinese philosopher of any consequence is Sun Tzu, and he set the stage for all of future Chinese history by saying that deception is virtuous. And so, as Kissinger's probably told us, I guess it was a surprise to him, but to me it's culture of deceit. Whereas if you, I just put a post out this the other day, if you look at, in the Arab or Muslim world, lying is heroic. If you can get away with lying on behalf of your people, then that's great.
Well, what is the shield of King David? Right? King David's shield is deception. He cheats on the field of honor against the Philistine Goliath, who is probably an Aryan of some sort, who is operating under the essentially Greek or Indo-European ethical mentality.
And this is what is a wonderful book by one of our better military historians, and it's called The Culture of War. It's by Martin Van Creveld, and in that he tries to go into this. He says this is why Westerners get into trouble all the time, is we don't understand that, you know, we evolved the settlement of disputes. Our idea is to settle dispute quickly, get it over with, and move on. Whereas other parts of the world, they don't move by that ethic at all. So you can't think winning means settling a dispute. Winning in some places means never giving up and wearing your enemy down or waiting for the opportunity. That's certainly the Chinese strategy, is to say it doesn't matter, it doesn't matter, it doesn't matter, while they build up enough resources to the point where you can't really do anything about it.
Right. Right.
So I plug Martin Van Creveld's book there, The Culture of War. It was a great analysis of that basic thing. Well, you know, I've taken the same position on truth-telling, is that Westerners invented truth and truth-telling. It was an incredibly expensive thing. I'm not sure that people in any other region of the world had the right circumstances. I mean, we're fairly old people in Europe. We're not diverse. We're heterogeneous. We've been intermarrying forever. It's contrary to the history the Romans produced, because they wanted to cause barbarians so they could prey upon us. But, you know, metal workers weren't exactly primitive people or poor. That's why the Romans felt they could profit from the attack Europe. And the same thing happened with the church. The church tries to create the barbaric image of Europe, and this isn't really true. I mean, we had a pretty much very close to our own industrial revolution in the Copper Age in England, so much so that in the British Isles, we're producing enough copper that not even using flint tools anymore, which is kind of ridiculous, because, you know, I don't know if you've ever been to the cliffs of Dover, but the, you know, flint's laying around on the ground everywhere to pick up and make into something. And so if you're abandoning that resource to use copper, which is kind of difficult to make, and you're throwing sacrifices into the water and stuff with copper tools and copper weapons, the reason you're doing that is because you have so much of it, it's cheap. So we didn't have a primitive culture. We had a pretty old culture, and unfortunately the only mistake we got is because we didn't. The same reason that allowed us to develop truth and allowed us to not develop authoritarian hierarchical structures is the same reason we didn't develop writing. You know, we had our druids, they had to develop writing because we never had to keep inventories.
Right.
So we never had taxes and inventories to handle all these monolithic structures. So we didn't develop those things. So I don't know how I got on this. I can't remember the chain of reasoning I was trying to get to, which was why I was talking about the our model here. Anyway, truths, different truths. So we're the only people to develop truth because we have a fairly unique circumstance of being out here on the edge of the Bronze Age in a homogeneous polity full of rivers and great farmland. So that and you got to call us the North Sea people.
Mm-hmm.
And so we have a sort of explosion of something up in Finland and Sweden at some point, which I guess we'll figure out in the next 10 or 20 years exactly what happened. And then we had, what we probably think the Hallstatt area cultures, German culture spreading out from there. And we did pretty well here, even with waves of immigrants from the area of Ukraine or the steppe with their horses.
Mm-hmm.
But we developed truth, and everybody else didn't. Now, what happens when you tell the truth is really interesting, is that from an economic point of view, your transaction costs go down. So, I mean, everybody suppresses violence, right? I mean, every culture tries to suppress violence, and certainly everybody tries to suppress theft, and some cultures suppress fraud, although I call them bizarre cultures, like in the shopping center, bizarre culture. They don't suppress fraud. They revel in it. I mean, it's just part of the culture to try to defraud somebody. But once you start doing this, once you suppress fraud, and then you suppress, then you say, well, I'm going to even use the nuclear family, and then the absolute nuclear family, and I'm going to use manorialism, which means you can't get land unless you're married and have a family that can run it. So you can't really breed. You have late marriage. If you put all those things together, what you get is the total suppression of free riding. We don't have winters like, I mean, we don't have African winters, right? You can't make it through the winter on your own. You can't survive. So we had a really interesting system up here for suppressing the rates of reproduction of the underclasses and suppressing free riding in all walks of life, even right up to the absolute nuclear family, where you don't even support your children once they leave the house.
Mm-hmm.
So what happens in this case is that what happens to economic velocity? Well, I mean, if you look at Greece, which you just brought up, Hellenic Greece, I mean, Athens hadn't hit Sparta, by the time we get to, Archimedes, we've basically got the Industrial Revolution. You know, it takes very little time from the time that the Northern Europeans move into shipping and they re-explore the Enlightenment for us to produce 500 years of technological advancement that drag humanity out of ignorance and poverty. So the wonderful thing about truth-telling is it suppresses all sorts of verbally constructed free riding, lying and that kind of stuff. And when you do that, you get all this incredible decrease in transaction costs, trade, and you get all this ability to take risk.
Right.
So that's wonderful, but we also had the institutionalization of that. I mean, wonderful institutionalization. We have the common law, again, because we don't have a hierarchical system. Hope I'm not losing you here. Am I doing okay with this?
Oh yeah, this is good.
So if we have since we don't have a hierarchical system, we don't have to manage irrigation or we don't have to manage aqueducts or anything like that, or rivers or water rights. Since we don't have to manage all those things, we don't have it. We still keep the common law around. Well, the great thing about the common law and truth telling together is really interesting. First, you can have juries instead of authorities. The second thing, and the common law keeps the law simple, but the most important thing about it is the first person who files a suit. So if I come up with a brand new way of scamming somebody, and I take you, right, and you take me to court, that becomes law right then. As soon as the first crime is processed and turns into law, that opportunity to cheat is suppressed. So what happens over time is no matter what you do, I mean, as soon as you start cheating, you just sort of develop this attitude that it just doesn't pay. Because it's not like there's a time delay. There's no way for me to have to petition somebody to keep this rent seeking available. So what you have is we've combined the total suppression of free riding with the most effective way of rapidly suppressing any technological increase in free riding or parasitism. And we've, in the process, created the perfect means to have evolution of commerce and trade, despite being out here on the fringes of Eurasia.
Right, right.
So that's why in both periods we have the rapid accumulation of scientific knowledge, because scientific knowledge is basically truth telling. That's what you try to do when you do science. Now people say, what's the scientific method? I mean, we have all sorts of people talk about this stuff. It's really fascinating, but you know, what does that entail? Well, you know, what is the scientific method? It's not scientific at all. We just use it in the sciences, but the method is, how do I launder imagination, excuse me, error, imagination, wishful thinking, bias, and deceit from my expressions, from my statements. How do I launder all those things? So we tend to think, because we evolved reason and science, the way we did it was we evolved it because we had juries, right? We had juries, then we had a sort of senate, and you stood in front of these peers and you argued. We got good at it. We had truth telling and they could judge you. We got reason and now we got science out of it.
Exactly. I mean, you see the emergence of these things certainly at the same time in ancient Greece.
Right. And when you get that process gets to science, you know, the problem is that moral constraints, when you and I make moral as well as legal arguments, it's justificationary. We're saying, I can do this because, or I did that because, and so it's a justificationary process. So the problem is that when we discovered math, this might be way too deep. If it got too deep for your audience, I'm trying to keep this is very fascinating stuff, but if I'm getting too deep, you can tell me.
My audience really loves the heavy duty philosophical
stuff. Okay, well, let me lay this on them then, because this is really fascinating. So one of the first, you know, you probably remember that above the Plato's, what do you call the stair, not the stair, the porch. It said, all who cannot speak geometry don't get to enter here, or something of that record, that nature. Well, the problem when you get into mathematics is just like morality is justificationary, right? You say, I had a contract. Well, the contract says I can do this, therefore I can do it, right? That's justification. Well, what happened when we get into mathematics? The way you explore math, which is mathematical operations, right, and the way that you you test math, you criticize math, is through those same operations. That's so much the same that it's indistinguishable. So we went from moral justification to legal justification to this new thing, which you've got to remember that they thought of math as very close to magic. And that became to them justificationary. But the problem is, math is the thing that is the most justificationary, right? I mean, it's basically a tautology. You say, I'm going to define this, and then it's going to be that. So the problem you get when you get into science, which is correspondence with the real world, is the way you think about the real world isn't with operations, it's with observations, because we don't know what the operations are that the world universe runs by. We're still trying to figure those out. And so the problem we didn't come up with until really Karl Popper is that truth telling is moral justification, and truth telling are opposites. I justify morality because that's what we've agreed to, whether normatively or contractually. I justify contracts. I justify adherence to the law, but I don't justify science. I criticize it. Whatever's left when I finish just trying to tear apart this idea in science is what must be true, or as true as I can get it. So science is a critical exercise. Well, so we unfortunately got into this problem where nobody sort of figured this out until Popper comes along, and he doesn't finish it. So is it okay if I take one more leap now? So we've got this history, right? We've got this history of moral justification, then mathematics setting us on the wrong course, confusing us that science is justificationary, right? Or that scientific investigation is, and then we get up to Karl Popper, we get up to Darwin, and he says, well, actually it's random selection. And then we get up to Karl Popper, and he says, actually it's criticism it's basically whatever survives must be a truth candidate.
Let me just back up here for a sec. Mm-hmm. I just want to make sure that I'm getting this straight. Mm-hmm. Mathematics is, or any kind of purely deductive reasoning, you start out knowing the first principles, and then you draw the conclusions.
Mm-hmm.
With nature, we don't know the first principles.
Correct.
In effect, we see the conclusions, namely we see the effects, we see the phenomena.
Mm-hmm.
And the scientific project is really an attempt, as it were, to get to the first principles, the operating
Correct.
System, whatever.
Yep.
And since we have to do that based on experience, and yet we have to go beyond experience, in a sense, we have to make guesses about Yep. what the universal principles and necessities are that are operative in phenomena that we see.
Mm-hmm.
And that always has an element of going beyond what we observe.
Mm-hmm.
And if we can hypothesize an underlying principle, then deduce other implications from that, we can set up tests where we can either confirm or deny this principle by seeing if the predicted implications happen or don't happen. And so there's a process of using imagination to come up with hypotheses about the first principles of nature and then subjecting those things to, well, we can subject them to rational criticism to make sure that they're coherent, and we subject them to empirical criticism by basically seeing if we can come up with empirical counterexamples that refute them.
Yes.
Is that basically what you're saying?
That's beautiful. Well, thank okay. you. God, you made my day.
Okay.
So we get to where we basically understand this about science, but for some reason, we don't make the next leap. And I'll tell you why it happened. We didn't make the next leap, the leap to what, testimonialism, which is what I work on. The problem is that we're trying to launder our imagination from our hypothesis. We come up with hypotheses purely by imaginary means. It doesn't matter how we come up with a hypothesis. However we come up with it means nothing to the truth of it. In other words, it doesn't matter what math I do, all that matters is does it survive criticism? And so the whole operational revolution failed. And it failed, and the worst part is that it failed just the time when we needed it not to. Well, the same thing happens in philosophy, is that how do we know when people are telling the truth and lying? And this is the whole trick, is because starting with Freud and Cantor and Marx, then we get into the postmoderns and the progressives and the feminists and the Keynesians in economics. How much truth is being told and how many untruths are being told? And we talked earlier about the whole secret to the Western progress was that we told the truth, that we built the high trust society, that we reduced transaction costs, increased the ability to innovate, created the least amount of friction, and the least time delay between the invention of some kind of scam and the suppression of it. But what's happened during the 20th century is what Hayek warned us about. He said that the 20th century is going to be remembered as an age of mysticism. Now, mysticism, he meant that because he only had this language available at the time, but we really have pseudoscience, is what the 20th century is. It's a century of pseudoscience. It's a century of deceit. It's a century of lying. I mean, what is progressivism other than lying?
Yeah, what is the idea of the social construction of gender or race or
it's
whatever?
It's a lie.
Yeah, it is, exactly.
It's lying.
And how does political correctness work? Well, it entrenches lies and makes them immune from criticism and being groomed out. You can't file a suit against your anthropology professor for swindling you in the same way that you can file suit against some guy, who's doing some telemarketing scam or something like that. Maybe we should be able to do that.
Well, that's what I agree, is what I think, is that, we forget that the state took away our right to sue those people on purpose. The state took away our right and put legislators between us and the courts where we used to be able to sue a company for polluting. You used to be able to sue people for lying. I mean, the people don't know this, but I mean, in Anglo-Saxon law is hysterical. It's wonderful. Reading old laws is beautiful. And, calling a woman a whore is the same penalty as hitting a guy in the back of the head with an axe and exposing his skull. So, I mean, this is basically, that's equivalent to attempted murder. So you didn't call a woman a whore. Well, I mean, we had libel and slander and the duel. Why did we have the duel?
To raise the cost of being an asshole, basically. Yeah.
Defamation? Why do we have those things? So we systematically removed all the laws that allowed us to control truth-telling. We removed all the traditions of truth-telling. We removed grammar, history, almost removed spelling, but grammar, history, and rhetoric from our school systems. And I got to tell you, if we just made the argument that truth-telling is the secret to Western competitive advantage over all other cultures, and it's the reason we've dragged humanity out of ignorance and poverty, if you can't stand in front of a jury of your peers and orate rationally, you're not Western.
You think of Athenian democracy in the 5th century B.C. You could gain political power. You could come from nowhere. You had to be a citizen. You couldn't be a foreigner. But you could come essentially from nowhere in the social hierarchy at the very bottom. And if you had the power to speak persuasively, you could gain political power. And that created the necessity of criticism, of arguments. Because if people can gain power by speaking, and they can gain power by speaking falsely and deceptively, you have to be able to separate good and bad arguments. So that's how rhetoric, that's how logic, that's how epistemology, it all came into being.
It all came from that.
Out of that crucible, if you will,
yep.
of a society where there were juries, where there were orators, and where that was the route to political power. Where there were assemblies as well as juries, and people deliberated together in public, and you know, you had to guard the flow of truth in that kind of society through the invention of criticism. And really, when you look at academia today, outside the sciences and even within the sciences, I mean, basically everything in the humanities is bullshit. There's some survivals of earlier, more rational eras still floating around. But practically everything in, say, literary criticism, anything that's taught in, like, a comparative literature program or these race and gender studies programs and things like that, these critical theory programs, is basically lies and bullshit protected from any kind of external criticism, ultimately by indoctrination of people who are within the system, and exclusion of dissenters.
So, we, in order to fix that problem, right, in order to go from where we still can't do violence and theft, it's pretty hard to do fraud in our culture. But we can use lying and propaganda, the new media, right? Once we had media, you know, radio, television, and mass market magazines, it became a lot easier to spread propaganda and lies. So we'd have to have a way to stop it. Well, you know, the way you stop it is you just take back our right of universal standing, which is that, and you declare the informational commons a common. In other words, I can't pollute the air, I can't pollute the water, I can't destroy the land. In other words, there's no right of abuses, right? I can use the air, I can use as a right of uses, I can have right of fructus of the land, I can, you know, grow things on it, but I can't destroy the land, can't destroy the, so, but I can't, I have the same, limitations on the informational economy. In other words, the informational commons. So, I can't pollute, destroy, I have no right to damage the informational commons. You know, why do people have that right? I mean, one of the things that bothers me is Americans are really comfortable lying about products and services. You know, if you go to a Finn, you go to a Finn or a German, they don't take that.
It's very interesting. If you look at some of the causes of the English Civil War, the Puritan Revolution, what were these people chafing against? They were chafing against royal patents, they were chafing against, and by patents, basically, they were chafing against standards of honesty about mm-hmm. the content of their wares and things like that.
Yep.
They wanted to be able to lie, basically, and get away with it. And to do that, the monarchy had to go. And why did they have this attitude? Well, because they basically had this, ultimately, it's this Calvinist attitude, and it's the father of the lowest form of pragmatism, which is that, yeah, you might lie, you might cheat, you might steal, but if you get away with it, that is a sign of divine favor, right? And mm-hmm. so, really, the only criterion for this kind of mentality is whether you're, quote-unquote, a winner in the end. And I think the incredibly low standards of truth-telling in America, especially in commerce, but certainly also in politics, really has to do with that.
Yeah, Americans still tell the truth in court. I mean, that's the thing. We tell the truth to each other, we tell each other in court. But we treat politics like advertising. And so we don't, it's one of those things, I mean, we shouldn't have reduced libel, slander, defamation, and dueling. I mean, fighting, I live in Ukraine, I mean, you do not talk trash to other men here. It doesn't take, there's nobody getting chuffy outside of clubs. It's like an armed society is a polite society. Well, you don't, in Russia or this part of, you don't go around, doing bravado stuff unless you want to lose your teeth. I mean, it's actually kind of funny here. I noticed it right away. How many guys have bandaged hands on, Sunday mornings? Because they didn't like somebody, something somebody said when they got drunk. But, you know, we shouldn't have gotten rid of those things because what they did was they brought in a culture of lying. And then we took our tolerance for marketing, Yankee peddlers, and we expanded that tolerance for Yankee peddlerism to political discourse. And I don't think our founders understood, and this is the problem, the central thing I think I've solved with proprietarianism, is that our founders didn't really understand the idea of the difference between, that people would actually go and lie, you know, that could use the media to intentionally lie on that scale. They might have, but why didn't they say free truthful speech and not truthful speech? I mean, if you can go out and tell the truth, I mean, none of us, I mean, that's great. But why should why should free speech include lying? You know, so the real problem is, you tell me how to, in the era of human scale, in other words, up to, you know, the middle 1800s, in the era of human scale, what does human lying mean? Well, I mean, you can tell me what you think and what you do, and I can perceive it. But what happens between 1880 and the early part of the 20th century, first half of the 20th century, when all these guys that I've just gone through and all these fields are trying to solve some problem they can't wrap their arms around, is that we've passed from consideration of problems of human scale, where the community is my extended family, my region, and possibly my state, you know, my state in the ancient terms. Instead, you know, we're talking about vast economies. We're using mathematics to estimate them. We're using calculus and statistics. We're discovering electromagnetism. We're talking about abstracts such as rights. And so what happened is, our ability to test the truth didn't keep up with our ability to lie. So just what had happened is, the West had used the common law for thousands of years, or its precursor, for thousands of years, and our absence of authoritarian hierarchy to suppress this growth of deception, and, as a matter of fact, all but eradicate it in every walk of life. But, you know, I have some But so what happens is we get beyond human scale, though, and because the government's trying to make sure that industry succeeds, and they want to give them some license, they take away our ability to police the commons. Because politicians want power, they take our ability to defend the commons. Because they want to have, you know, they want to take the power from the nobility and centralize it in bureaucracy, they take our rights to sue corporations, you know, to sue for pollution. So what happened is we had a sort of catastrophe happen to our traditions. And so what I've tried to do is repair that the failure of the operational revolution, which should have taken science. Remember, science was critical, and philosophy and morality and law were justificationary. And I've tried to say, I've tried to fix the problem that science wasn't addressing, another science, the art of laundering imaginary nonsense, error, deceit, bias, and whatever from our conversation, our utterances, and extend science into, in other words, truth-telling, into the informational commons and matters of economics, politics, and law. In other words, ethics. So the problem is, how do you actually do that? How do you write law? How do you write truth-telling so that people know how to tell the truth so they can speak truthfully, and moreover, how they can identify lying and how they can punish people for lying? I mean, we can protect, I mean, because we, you got to think of it, truth is a commons, right? We built this like an institution, right? It's like, it's our aqueduct, right? It's our system of law. Well, we built that. And the West has weaponized the commons as our competitive advantage, just like Islam has weaponized religion, just like Chinese have weaponized deceit, just like the Jews have weaponized rational pseudoscience. You know, these things have all been used as our competitive economic strategies. Well, if we want, we can re-empower our people, every individual, every man a sheriff, through the common law to police the informational commons just as we police every other commons. The problem is you have to have a way of testing the truth. Now, I think we've probably covered enough mind-bending history here to assault any, assault the tolerance of almost any audience, but it's possible to warranty your speech, just like scientists warranty their speech. It's possible for us to warranty that our speech is truthful. We can't tell you it's true, but we can say that we've warrantied it.
Meaning that we're speaking in good faith, that it's subject to criticism. What do you mean warranted exactly? That,
well,
we guarantee that it'll stand up to the test of time.
Well, no, I mean, if I'm not allowed to create a hazard, right? Right? And so if we have this in every walk of life, I mean, you're accountable for your actions. So why am I not accountable for my verbal actions? I mean, I don't understand.
Right.
I mean, we have an informational commons out there that is, you know, it's like one of those things. We got the machine to amplify the power of man's physical body. We have the media to amplify words the same way. This creates vast asymmetries of capability. So, you know, if you have you're Mr. Putin. I mean, you can create vast lies on a daily basis. I mean, if you're the American media, I mean, you can create vast lies, and there's no way to stop it because the manufacture of lies is always cheaper than the manufacture of truths because
right.
Truth can only be constructed through very expensive criticism.
Right. Well, so, let me ask you something. Do you think that the Internet and the emergence through the Internet of alternative media is helping spread the truth? I know that the Internet is a great means for telling lies.
Well, what the Internet has done is allowed each of us to seek confirmation bias, extremely granular confirmation biases.
Right.
So what we really do is we our moral intuition is evolves to roughly reflect our reproductive strategies. And so what each of us does is gravitate towards some information stream that confirms our moral intuitions and provides us means of justifying our reproductive strategies. And that's what we do. And so all that's happening is, you know, is instead of having, you know, X, you know, half a dozen minor, you know, half a dozen marginally indifferent philosophical movements, we've now spawned, many, many little eddies in the informational stream of, that roughly correspond to whatever the minimum criteria, whatever the minimum populace and noise is necessary to create enough of a pattern to create a voice on the web for your reproductive strategy, justification of a reproductive strategy. So, I mean, you might say truth is really good. It's very hard to get out there, but it isn't hard to, in other words, lie, but it isn't hard to go in and feed information, feed cognitive biases, moral biases, reproductive strategic reproductive biases. It isn't hard to go do that. I mean, feminist channels, guys like us listen to paternal, Western civilization channels. I mean, this is what we all do. We all specialize because we're able to informationally specialize now.
Right, so you see it as a kind of bleak development in the sense that it allows everybody to confirm their prejudices, but doesn't it also at least give the possibility of criticizing things that otherwise just could not have been criticized, getting your voice heard, whereas in the past it was simply drowned out? I mean, I know that happened.
Yeah, it does. I just don't know if it matters. You know, in the end, I don't see it affecting anything. All I see in the data is people vote their racial and religious and marital status. I mean, that's it. That's all I see. I don't see anything else. So, and that's increasingly happening. It's happening for reasons Jonathan Haidt tries to argue, you know, demonstrate, is that, you know, once the political parties, he doesn't say this, but once the South was no longer polarized against the Republican Party, then the Democrat and Republican parties could specialize in moral compasses, and they have been. And so what you have is the Republican Party increasingly becoming the party of white people, and the Democratic Party increasingly becoming the party of non-white people and white single mothers. And that's just what's happening. So whether you want to say this or not, I mean, first past the post voting processes produce exactly what we get here. They produce the need for people to vote morally rather than on individual policies. When they do that, you see mere amplification of moral axes in different parties. In the end, you know, it's just gene expression in voting booth.
Interesting. So Kurt, this has been a really very good conversation. I think our audience has probably reached the limits of what they can assimilate in one conversation. So it's a very...
That wouldn't surprise me.
It's been a very rich feast, so we don't want to give them one more wafer of information, one wafer too many. So why don't we just say that this is going to be the first of a number of conversations, because I really enjoy this, and it's been very thought-provoking for me. So, Kurt, thank you very much for being on Countercurrents Radio. Is there anything you'd like to say just to sort of put a final exclamation on it?
I just want to thank you. I realize what I do is not non-trivial, and it's just a joy. And what my biggest fear is always that I'll talk to someone who doesn't understand me, and it's a hopeless, frustrating experience. And I really want to thank you. I really enjoyed the talk. You're a smart guy. You know your material, and you grok stuff very quickly. It's really great. So thank you very much.
Well, thank you.